Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, it is Mike Terzai's last day as Speaker of the Pennsylvania State House. He's leaving on the heels of a tumultuous week in the General Assembly. Also, we'll have a conversation with Jane Golden, founder of Philadelphia's Mural Arts Program, on the long relationship between art and social justice movements. But first, New Jersey continues to reopen as the number of new coronavirus cases drops. It has been a long and devastating journey. At last check, at least 12,400 have died, and over 160,000 have been diagnosed with COVID-19 since the first case was reported in New Jersey in early March. Because of the coronavirus, the state could face a combined revenue shortfall of close to $10 billion through the end of fiscal year 2021. And yet there's a glimmer of hope as phase two of New Jersey's effort to restart the economy takes effect today. Brent Johnson has been covering this story for NJ Advanced Media, and he has the very latest on what's opening and any restrictions. Hi, Brent.
Hi, thank you for having me. Good to be here.
So before we get to phase two, Brent, one big story recently has been the lifting of the stay-at-home order for New Jerseyans, which had been in effect for close to 3 months. What was Governor Murphy's reasoning here?
Well, he said that, you know, if you looked over the last month in New Jersey after almost 3 months of lockdown order, the number of daily cases, hospitalizations, and deaths in New Jersey have dropped significantly over time, about 70% to 80% since peaking in mid-April. So with these lockdown effects, these lockdown orders taking effect and doing some good, the governor said it is now time to start lifting them, but lifting them gradually, not doing it all at once, because he said that would be too dangerous.
Yeah. And masks and social distancing will be with us for a while yet.
Yeah, basically he said until there's a vaccine or a proven widespread effective treatment, that you need to take that precaution, that there will be social distancing inside stores, limited capacity, and you have to wear a mask when you're out.
So with the advent of phase two today, there is some relief for restaurants and non-essential retail. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so it's starting today. It's called stage two of the reopening, as the governor calls it. It starts with outdoor dining. So restaurants and eateries and bars have been limited to takeout and delivery since March 16th. And this will allow them to have some sort of outdoor dining space. Some restaurants have that built in. Some have been putting up tents in parking lots. When you drive through roads in New Jersey right now, you can see tents popping up all over the place in parking lots. And then there's non-essential retail, meaning stores that have been closed for 3 months can now start welcoming customers back inside, as long as they wear masks and social distance. And they've been limited to curbside for the last few weeks, but they've been closed physically since March 21st.
Brent, there has been some pushback to the continuation of restrictions in some way, shape, or form. Tell us about what's going on at Asbury Park.
Yeah, well, Asbury Park, it's a tad confusing. Some of these lifting of the orders have been a tad haphazard and confusing, and some things can open and some things can't. It's a lot to take in. So a few days ago, the governor allowed indoor gatherings in New Jersey to increase to 50 people. It went from 10 to 50 people. And a lot of people took that to mean, well, we could open up restaurants. And he said, no, restaurants are not included. This is mostly for churches and religious services. But Asbury Park, the city council in Asbury Park said, well, we read that as we can open up restaurants indoors limited at 50 people. And so they passed an ordinance and said, restaurants in the city, you can start that Monday. And Murphy's office said, no, that's not what we meant. They sued. They apparently tried to talk to the city and had to sue them. And then a judge stopped it and Asbury Park backed off.
Tense times.
All right.
So daycare centers can reopen. What does reopening for a daycare look like? Do we know what the state guidelines are for face covering and distancing, you know, for the adults, for toddlers? I can't even imagine how distancing will or even can work with little ones.
Yeah, that's a sticky situation. There will be temperature checks of kids and staff members when they arrive, limited class sizes. Children will be encouraged but not required to wear masks. So because they said it might be make it more difficult if kids are wearing masks and constantly touching their faces and pulling it off. And no one under the age of two will be required to wear a mask. So the masks on children are a little bit more lax. But yeah, there will be class size limits and temperature checks, and it will not be business as usual at places like this.
Okay. Still can't get that haircut just yet?
One more week. You can barbershops and salons open next Monday.
How's the entertainment scene look? Movies, concerts, theater?
Yeah, I mean, none of those. And he made it very clear when he lifted the indoor gatherings from 10 to 50, he said no comedy clubs, no concert venues, no performing halls, no movie theaters. For all intents and purposes, those may be among the last to come back because you have people confined in an indoor, close space. And maybe there's a way to do it with capacity limits in the future, but we have no clue when that'll be. And for a state like New Jersey, where live music in places like Asbury Park and a good theater scene, you know, that hurts a lot of sectors of our economy.
And gyms are still off limits as well.
Yes, but that is part of stage two.
Okay.
Basically, they're rolling out stage two in a gradual fashion. So gyms are coming later in stage two, but they haven't been given a date yet.
Swimming pools, Brent, open next Monday, the 22nd. But
yes.
Here again is kind of a funny situation. Maybe not funny, but, you know, one that's going to be tough to navigate. Lifeguards will likely have their hands full because the governor's office apparently wants to see social distancing in the water.
Yeah, he keeps saying, the thing Murphy keeps saying is social distancing will remain the watchword. So I know they know chlorine can kill the virus, but I guess there's fear about people getting too close to each other. You know, yeah, these are it's weird times. They're strange. You know, you don't really have answers for a lot of these things, and you have to be extra cautious. But some people on the other side of the coin say this is too much, and there's no way that this virus could pass through water. So there, yeah, as you said, there's a lot of tension about all this.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see how it rolls out because, again, this image of kids in the water trying to social distance is one that might or might not work. They might have to shift things as they go along. Any other pool rules we should know about prompted by the coronavirus?
Yeah, my favorite one was no pool toys. So you can't have noodles or floaties. So because that could carry the virus, at least possibly. So if you go in the water, you can't bring any of those noodles that you see at pools at your friend's house.
Okay. So back to the stay-at-home order, which had been in effect no longer. Businesses were required to allow employees to work remotely from home if at all possible. This is no longer a requirement. In light of the fact that the pandemic is still with us, is work from home being encouraged? How are businesses reacting here?
Yeah, the governor is still saying if you can work from home, if your workers can work from home, please, companies, please let workers work from home. Again, it is not a requirement anymore. The stay-at-home order was lifted. But Murphy's office has also put out recommendations but not requirements of people that can have protections if they do decide to stay home. And if they do go back to work, companies have to follow certain guidelines. But nothing seems to be required. It's a little bit of a gray area. But, yeah, he's still encouraging people, if you can work from home, please work from home. But that's where lifting the stay-at-home order no longer made it a requirement.
And even if workers, again, do come back to the office, there will be many fewer people in the building, correct?
Yes. Just because of indoor capacity limits, you know, if you work at an office where you have 250 people, right now indoor gatherings are limited to 50, so you can't have more than 50 people in an indoor space. So that's just, you know, until that gets lifted, that's the way it is.
So outdoor gatherings increased from, what, 25 to 100?
Yes, and they'll be going up in coming weeks.
Okay. Governor Murphy had made an exception for even larger gatherings, such as protests, after getting some flack from Republican members of the state assembly.
Some Republicans have really hit him hard because he went marching in a Black Lives Matter, a pair of Black Lives Matter protests last Sunday. And they said, well, you know, if you're not following your own orders, why does everyone else have to? They called him a hypocrite. And he has said that this is a bigger moment than any of us, and we have to make sure we don't lose sight of this moment in American history, and that racism is a stain that has to be eradicated in America. But, you know, he was put between a rock and a hard place. He's marching in the gatherings, which clearly violated his rules on outdoor gatherings. So a day after being criticized, he lifted it to say that all protests and all religious services don't have limits on the size when they're outdoors.
And there has been considerable concern about the protests across the country, in that social distancing is still recommended, mask wearing is recommended because COVID is still with us. If what I'm reading in New Jersey is true, the rule for mask wearing seems to be easing a bit, at least in regard to large outdoor gatherings such as protests. Is that the case?
I don't know of anything specifically easing with mask wearing in terms of outdoor gatherings, but okay. I do know that he has specifically asked protesters, if you are marching, please social distance if you can, which can be difficult in outdoor protests, wear a mask and get tested. He said, we need to know if this is spreading. So he is on one hand saying it's okay to protest, but also saying please do it responsibly is what he keeps saying.
Yeah. And as you mentioned just a moment or so ago, as we move forward with stage two, the size of outdoor gatherings will be allowed to grow. So this is good news, Brent, for schools which want to hold commencement.
Yes. Yeah, it is supposed to grow up to 500 by July 6th. July 6th is the date he's told schools that they can have outdoor commencement ceremonies, and he's increased it to 500. That makes it difficult for some large school districts. I went to East Brunswick High School in the center of the state, and we had a class of about 750, so we would have to break that up into two different commencement ceremonies. But yeah, this would allow outdoor commencement ceremonies. Again, socially distant, but only 500 people would be the limit.
Okay. Let's take a look at New Jersey's unemployment rate. How many have filed for unemployment? Are there any new numbers, any approximations?
Yeah. Well, the total since mid-March has been more than 1.2 million New Jerseyans, which is one-ninth of our population. Mm-hmm. The new filings have dropped significantly over the past few weeks as people start going back to work and these orders start getting lifted. But yeah, I mean, 1.2 million since mid-March. It's just an insane number when you think about it.
Yeah, there might also be some more help for small businesses on the way through the State Economic Development Authority.
Yes, they have a grant program they've been running, and they just announced the second round of that grant money. And small businesses that are struggling can apply. And this is multiple millions of dollars to help people get back on their feet who run small businesses. So the state is trying to find ways to reach out to those businesses.
And back to the stage two, the reopening process, does it shift into reverse? Again, remind us if COVID numbers start to go back up.
Well, he said that this morning. He was on the Today Show this morning and said that, yeah, we have to leave that option on the table. New Jersey has seen the numbers drop significantly in recent weeks. There was an uptick in deaths on Saturday. For the first time in 10 days, there were more than 100 deaths. But New Jersey's not seeing the numbers that Florida and other states like Arizona and Texas are seeing the increase. But we're still not two full weeks away from when the protests started. Yeah. We're still about 2.5 weeks since beaches reopened. So there are things that could trigger a spike. But right now, state officials are saying they're not seeing any major spike.
Okay, I got to stop you there, Brent. Great information.
Yeah, no problem.
We'll keep an eye on this story. Brent Johnson reports for NJ Advanced Media. Stay with us for more Radio Times.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As the Pennsylvania State Legislature increasingly finds itself embroiled in issues surrounding social justice and the coronavirus pandemic, State House Speaker Mike Terzai is spending his last day at the Capitol Complex in Harrisburg. Terzai announced his resignation on Wednesday without elaborating on his next step. He's a conservative Republican who spent years locking horns with Democratic Governor Wolf on issues including the minimum wage and a shale tax. And Terzai's absence will leave a vacuum in Pennsylvania's 28th legislative district that Democrats are hoping to fill. Terzai has spent nearly 20 years as a member of the State House of Representatives, and we are now going to take a look at his time as a lawmaker and House Speaker. Cynthia Fernandez has been reporting on this story for Spotlight PA. Welcome, Cynthia.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And Angela Columbus covers legislature for Spotlight PA as well. Hi, Angela.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Welcome to both of you. Cynthia, first to you. Mike Terzai had said earlier this year that this would be his last year in office, but his announcement last week came just days after members of the Pennsylvania Legislative Black Caucus took control of the chamber, demanding that legislation addressing police reform be considered, this following the death of George Floyd. What do we know about the timing of Mike Terzai's announcement? Is there a sense that considering this moment in time, the resignation is coming out of left field?
So we've known since January that he was not going to finish his term, which ends in November. And this did come out of left field for me. I wasn't expecting it. But he did call for a special session. He did support for a special session to take up police reform bills. And he left it up to Governor Wolf to call that session. Now, Terzai had the power to call a special session to vote on police reform bills, but has not. And I don't think he will today before he officially resigns. So, yeah, this came out of left field for me, but I know that veteran reporters have been expecting Terzai to kind of step down for a while now.
There's also the pandemic and the General Assembly's vote last week to approve a resolution ending the state of emergency, which Wolf will likely veto. What a time to leave. Angela, what's your perspective on this?
Yeah, so I think the speaker, as Cynthia mentioned, he had announced earlier this year that he was going to leave, and there was an expectation that he wasn't going to run for re-election. There was an expectation that once there was a budget in place, and this is now pre-COVID, that once there was a budget in place, he would be leaving early. As people know, there has been a temporary budget in place now in Pennsylvania. It's been approved by the legislature. In some respects, I think this was a good time for him to exit, but he's also leaving during a very tumultuous time, both ideologically and in the legislature, about how to safely reopen the state, how to bring the state back to its economic situation back to normal. So it, in a way, it's not surprising that he's leaving on this note and allowing kind of the next generation of leaders to take on these very hefty issues.
Any indication as to where Mike Terzai might land? Angela?
Yes, the Associated Press had reported a couple months ago that he was going to Aqua America. We don't know exactly what he was going to be doing there, but the speaker is a lawyer by training and was a lawyer before he entered the legislature. So we think that he's going to be in some sort of counsel position for the company.
Cynthia, let's just spend a moment or so on the temporary budget. There are no tax increases in this spending plan and a lot of flat funding.
Yeah, so basically no tax increases, and the whole state is funded, you know, for 5 months, except for education. They get funding for a year. And, you know, this was put together quickly and passed quickly so that if there was more federal stimulus money coming in, they could use it to fill those revenue gaps that we're experiencing because, you know, the whole, quote, business closure. So that was their goal, and we expect there to be more budget talks in a few months or when there's a new federal stimulus act that's passed.
Angela, have Republicans and Democrats set their differences aside for the most part to address the state's financing during the pandemic crisis?
I think some people view it as kind of putting off the inevitable until after the November election. So as Cynthia mentioned, they passed a temporary budget, which is going to effectively allow them to run through after a very tumultuous November election. And at that point, they will have, in some respects, a better sense of what kind of money is going to be available to them from the federal government, and also what kind of deficit they're going to be looking at. The numbers will be stronger. And as a result, you know, some sort of view it as a temporary peace. And anybody who's followed Pennsylvania politics knows that budget talks since Governor Wolf was elected and became governor have been fraught, both over issues of spending and how to raise new revenues. And I think that that is a fight that will likely play out again in the fall.
Let me reintroduce you. Angela Columbus covers the legislature and the governor for Spotlight PA. Cynthia Fernandez covers the Capitol and state legislature for Spotlight PA. Back to police reform. Cynthia, what are Democrats asking for specifically, and what did they receive from Mike Terzai? Was he open to what they were asking for?
Well, Terzai said that he supports, you know, a police reform special session, but many Democrats have said we don't need a special session to vote on these bills. These bills have been in committee for over a year. Why not just pick them up now? And that's actually what happened this morning at 8 a.m. The Judiciary Committee in the House voted and passed a bill that would create a database of police misconduct and require every law enforcement agency to check that database and do a thorough background check before they hire any officer, any peace officer, or any sheriff. And this was something that Representative Chris Rabb has been pushing for a while now, and this was a direct result of the Pennsylvania Legislative Black Caucus, you know, taking control of the House floor last week and not letting the speaker go up to the rostrum until there was, you know, a solid plan to pick up these police reform bills. And so I spoke to some of those lawmakers today, and they were very happy that, you know, the bills were picked up with unanimous bipartisan support. And they are hopeful that more bills will be picked up and we'll get full House floors before the session ends next week.
So you mentioned bipartisan. Any legislation that passes needs the support of Republicans. It's a Republican majority legislature.
Yes. And so this was, you know, shocking. Chris Rabb said, I feel like an honorary Republican today, you know, because his bill passed with support. And this will be interesting to see how it plays out and to see if any amendments get snuck in there that kind of undo the purpose of the bill. But it's, you know, a pretty robust bill. People and advocates have been pushing for it. So a lot of Democratic lawmakers are happy that their bill was picked up and are hopeful that, you know, some of the other almost two dozen police reform bills will also be considered before the session ends.
Cynthia, at one point when members of the Legislative Black Caucus took control of the House chamber, Black House Democrats asked fellow lawmakers to join them kneeling for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. Most did. Some did not. Do we know how Terzai reacted?
I didn't see. He was not on the floor when that happened. Okay. I believe he was. I'm not sure if he was on the floor. It was hard to see what was happening because the feed actually cut off. The feed only, like the live streaming only begins once Terzai gavels in. And apparently the feed was going for his speech, but it cut off when any other lawmaker was speaking. So I only have Facebook feeds to go off on. And he was not visible when that was happening.
Yeah, I was just curious about that. Angela Columbus, who steps into the void created by Terzai's leaving, at least for the moment? Who might be the temporary House Speaker?
Well, there's a lot of talk about potentially having the current majority leader, Brian Cutler, step up into that position. There's also some talk about some other Republicans in leadership positions, including the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee and another Republican who also holds a leadership position. But I think that is currently playing out. Brian Cutler really hasn't said what his plans are going to be going forward. I think he's only been in the majority leader position for a little over a year, and I think he enjoys it, but I think that there is a lot of pressure. There will be a lot of pressure on him to make a decision between now and leadership elections as to whether he wants to go for the speaker's position.
I also saw Republican Representative Marcy, and I think it's Tepple. Am I pronouncing her name?
Right.
Tepple. Name bandied about. She is a Republican from Montgomery. Is her name still being talked about? And you know, Pennsylvania has never had a female Speaker of the State House, right?
Right, that's correct. It is. But I think that people are kind of seeing it now as an issue. Well, the idea for Marcy Tople was for her to step in to serve out the remainder of Chirizai's term, which would end in November. And then at that point, leadership elections could occur. But there is some sort of push within the party to kind of figure it out now rather than wait for later. So we'll see how that plays out.
Okay. Cynthia, Mike Terzai first took office as a state representative, I believe, in 2001. And as you report, his tenure has spanned five governors, I believe, two of them Democrats. There were some pitched battles. One involves abortion access. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, Terzai he's pretty vocal about the things that he cares about, and he's been pretty vocal about his pro-life stance, and he pretty much he has supported, you know, a lot of pro-life bills and pro-life amendments, and, you know, Democrats have always had issues with this. A lot of, you know, poison pills get amended into bills that carry this language that wouldn't permit abortions. And so an example of that is the telemedicine bill that was on the floor. And up until Democrats and Republicans were up for it until, you know, it got this poison pill of abortion pills would not be covered by telemedicine. And then it basically was not supported by Democrats anymore. So that kind of gives you an idea of the bipartisanship that, you know, Terzai and the Democrats have fought and battled with for, you know, over 5-6 years.
Angela, Governor Wolf has wanted to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour in steps. Terzai has been opposed. The wage is currently $7.25 an hour, where it's been stuck for about a decade. Where is Terzai coming from here?
Well, I think it's important to sort of put this into context. I mean, Terzai is a fiscal conservative, and his leadership has really played to the more conservative elements of his caucus, and that Republican caucus in the House has become more conservative over the last decade. And he's always taken the position that in pushing legislation that it have at least 102 Republicans, and that's obviously what you need to pass a bill in the legislature, that at least 102 Republicans support it. It's kind of been his MO as a leader. So where he's coming from on this is that there's a lot of pushback in his own caucus on raising the minimum wage. There's still many Republicans who think that that should be decided at the federal level, that it hurts small businesses. And he's not going to be pushing a bill that the majority of his caucus is not supportive of. So, honestly, I do not see that being a real issue that will come into play and get voted on between now and the end of the year, which also marks the end of the 2-year legislative session. So perhaps raising the minimum wage is going to become an issue again in the 2021-22 legislative session.
Cynthia, Democrats would be happy to flip Terzai's seat in the 28th district. As an observer, is this a likelihood?
There's been a lot of pundits, you know, looking at Allegheny suburbs and Pittsburgh suburbs and noting this phenomena of grassroots groups really, you know, organizing and trying to flip seats blue. A lot of people think that will happen to Terzai's seat, but that is yet to be seen. We'll know more in November.
I think is the count 9 Republican seats that Democrats are looking at to win the state House majority. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, I think it's quite a number, quite a big number.
Angela, as you report, Terzai has been a prolific fundraiser for Republican legislative candidates across the state. How does this role shift now that he's leaving the state capitol?
Well, if somebody's going to have to step in and do that work, and there are other pretty prolific fundraisers within the state House Republican caucus who will step up and take that role. But he was known as being a very energetic fundraiser. He would travel the state and really kind of whip up a lot of money that effectively helped him build very solid majorities over the last decade. And the politics were different when he fell into that role in 2011. That's when we had the huge conservative wave in Pennsylvania. And I think the person who steps up into that role now is facing a far different political landscape. And it may be difficult to raise money in the same way that Mike Terzai did.
Cynthia, Pennsylvania remains without a shale tax, not for lack of trying on the part of Democrats. Is this an issue you see now on hold until we get through the pandemic and the current budget crisis, maybe until sometime in 2021?
Yeah, the GOP is pushing back on anything that would, you know, incur more costs for people and companies. So I don't think this is going to get this will be an issue that will be taken up before the session ends in November.
Okay. Angela Columbus, accurate to say that Mike Terzai has been a powerful speaker. He talks. His fellow Republicans take notice.
Oh, absolutely. He's been a very active speaker. He's pushed many issues himself, including liquor privatization, using bills that effectively allow for public money to subsidize private schools, including religious schools. Typically, you don't see speakers step into those types of roles, very actively pushing legislation. But Mike Terzai was one of those speakers.
All right. Angela Columbus covers the legislature and the governor for Spotlight PA. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we appreciate your presence as well, Cynthia Fernandez, who covers the Capitol and the state legislature for Spotlight PA. Great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Stay tuned to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. Jane Golden, Executive Director of the Mural Arts Philadelphia, will talk about the role public art can play in social movements. That's coming up next. Stay tuned. Welcome back to
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Video Times, I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. One of the lasting images of the burgeoning social movement prompted by the death of George Floyd is that of the mural of former Philadelphia Police Commissioner and Mayor Frank Rizzo being covered up with beige paint by a diverse crew of people using rollers on extension poles. Rizzo was a polarizing figure in Philadelphia, known for his aggressive policing tactics in the black community. A statement from Mural Arts Philadelphia says, in part, "We know that the removal of this mural does not erase painful memories and are deeply apologetic for the amount of grief it has caused. We believe this is a step in the right direction and hope to aid in healing our city through the power of thoughtful and inclusive public art." For the rest of the hour, we're going to explore how art can reflect and speak to social change. Jane Golden is founder and executive director of Mural Arts Philadelphia. And Jane, it is so good to have you with us once again on Radio Times. Do we have Jane? Okay.
Hello,
Jane.
Hello.
Oh, it's so good to hear your voice. Hi, how are you?
It was thrilling to be here. I'm a fan of Radio Times, so thank you.
Well, thanks. All right, so as an artist, what is your take, Jane, on events of the past few weeks? And is there an opportunity for art to really help affect positive social change during these times?
Yes, I think that that art is so important in our lives. And if you think about different movements connected to muralism, the Mexican muralists, I mean, what they spoke about was really a reflection of what was going on in the country and started like a revolution. You think about the work created during the WPA, how that movement came out of the ashes of the Depression. And then, really, I think about contemporary muralism, and I date that back to 1968 with the Wall of Respect in Chicago. And, you know, and that was such a tumultuous time in our country. And African-American artists couldn't show their work in galleries and museums. And they said, that's not going to stop us. And so the work that they did about representation and identity, about the civil rights movement, about the Vietnam War, to say it was significant is like an understatement, because it, again, was revolutionary. And that what they did echoed throughout the country and the world. And it made an indelible mark on both the people in Chicago, but everywhere, that people felt like that they could use their power in a way that was unstoppable, and that they could make their mark, and that it would resonate with citizens everywhere about what was going on. And it was sort of a reclamation of identity, mm-hmm. and saying that you can't take this from us.
I'd like to talk more about muralist William Walker in just a moment or two, but let's kind of get the Rizzo mural covered here to start the show. What went into mm-hmm. the decision making to cover that mural, which had been in place about 25 years, Jane?
Yeah, well, it was a long time coming, and I so much went on behind the scenes for many years. It became a legal issue, and because the owners of the building and the lot are that's the rightful owner of the mural. Unfortunately, I wish that it was different. We see a lot of beautiful landmark murals go away, and we really can't do anything about it. And the artist had wanted it to stay, and we felt really strongly it got defaced again, that we couldn't fix it. We couldn't continue to fix it. We had spent a long time talking to people in the community, trying to understand all sides. We were empathetic, but at the end of the day, it was a mural that caused pain and division. And it goes against everything that I believe in, that we believe in as mural arts, about what public art can do. And so that was the leverage that we had. And thankfully the owners, they changed their mind. It was like, it was just this conversation. I was like, what? And it was, okay, this is a moment. And the artist, I talked to her, and she said, if it has to go away, that's fine. And we said, okay, this is going to happen quickly and swiftly. And so we made the plans to remove it early Saturday morning, a week ago.
The last I saw, I haven't been out to see, but the last I saw, there was a small corner in the upper right not painted over, the image of a parking sign. Is that still there?
Yes.
And what was the reasoning behind that?
I know if people were wondering about the significance. It's actually that we needed Pico to wrap the wires, but there had been a really bad storm, and like thousands of people were missing power, so that just wasn't a priority, which I totally understood. Okay. So, but we always want our team, our operations team, to be safe, so they had to leave that until the wires are wrapped, and then we'll go back and remove it.
Oh, interesting story. Are there plans in place for a new mural at 9th and Montrose in South Philly?
Yes, we're talking to the community, to the building owners, to the community, to artists who live down there, and we are going to be meeting this week and then again next week to make a plan. It is our advice that we should take our time, that we should have it be a space for reflection and healing, and really think about the possibilities of enlivening the space in alternative ways. Could we use it as a space while we gather information for spoken word, for poetry, to watch films? I mean, what are the creative things that we can do to gather information, to be respectful of all parties, to really do deep listening, and to not rush this? I think that would be a huge mistake. And it makes me think a lot of Monument Lab, because I thought that was such an interesting exhibition, and I give a lot of credit to Paul Farber and Ken Lum, the curators, because it was really about understanding history, memory, trauma, and how we take our time to deconstruct that and set up a space to gather information and people's ideas, thoughts, and feedback as a way of weaving people together. And I think that's what art can do.
So when you are speaking with communities and you have these diverse viewpoints and you have to say no to some of the viewpoints, that's got to be pretty hard.
It is. It's sort of amazing. We do 75 to 100 projects a year. It really is, because it's like, you know, in my next life, I think, oh, I'll work for the UN. I don't know. But it's sort of, you know, there's a lot of a good project manager is really a community organizer. It's really about going into an area and knowing that we have to ask questions. We can't make assumptions. We often don't have answers. We have to be very respectful. And I think that's the beauty of the work, is when you really understand that, understand and respect the authorship of that community, and that we're a visitor. And so I think, you know, when I look at the work around the city, I often think of it as the autobiography of our city. And it's been such an outpouring of wonder and magic and history and memory and heroes and struggle. But it's come out of this very organic process that's not didactic or prescriptive. And I think that is so important.
What are some of your favorite works in Philadelphia that speak to social change?
Well, there's one I really love, and it's called Healing Walls. And it's at Germantown in Glenwood. And we worked with victims of crime, the men in our class at Greater Fruit Prison, who are just extraordinary artists, and victims advocates. And it was a really difficult project. And it was about the impact and consequences of crime, and how are all voices heard, and how do we understand each other's pain, and then how do we start to put things together again to think about what it means to have a healthy community and city. And for a year, people were at odds with each other and wanted to claim they had more pain than the other, and actually could not see each other as, I think, as a person. They saw each other in very stereotypical ways. And I think it was when people started to paint together, once they got through the talking and the designs were created, which was a difficult process in itself, it was when people were sitting next to each other in this giant auditorium at Greater Fruit, that people started to see each other's humanity. It was really a moment of epiphany, because I was reminded once again about the power of art and how transformative it can be. And it started to, people, you could see the layers that sort of block us from each other started to peel away, and people started to engage and connect and see not just distinction and diversity, which is wonderful to see and lift up, but also a commonality. So projects like that, the more complicated they are the ones I like the best, because I feel sometimes it's really, it just is a struggle and to do it right, but it has real intention and integrity at the end of the day.
It sounds as if your philosophy, Jane, is more about tackling those issues which might make us uncomfortable, but in the end must hopefully bring us together, as opposed to beautification.
That is correct. And I think we need to sit with that discomfort now more than ever, actually, and be really humble and really listen. And I think if we can do that, you see how the work extends beyond the realm of public space to that of public action. It's almost the visualization of democracy, that sort of organic outpouring of public art. And I see it not just in Philly, but all over the country. You see these magnificent, you know, works of art that were created on the spot by trained and not trained artists, just making their mark. And there's something sort of beautiful and breathtaking about it. But for me, it goes, and always has gone, beyond sort of the physical development and revitalization. I mean, I think art for art's sake is wonderful, and I think that we all deserve beauty in our environment, absolutely 100%, but I love it that it becomes a tool for social transformation and change.
So
as the work can be sort of an object, a process, a catalyst, all those things at the same time.
Let's talk about William Walker briefly, as promised. Who was he? We'll go back to Chicago for a moment. And what became of the Wall of Respect?
Well, it's not there anymore, but there's a wonderful website that your listeners can go to. And William Walker was a wonderful artist and was a driving force behind the Wall of Respect. And, you know, I think that he was very brave. He had real courage and real sort of a vision for how he saw public art. And I just, like, he's definitely just one of my heroes, because I think, you know, if you think about the late 60s and sort of going into the streets and talking about representation, identity, you know, all the critical issues of the day without support in any way, right? It was just, you know, there was this movement that had just started. It's just sort of remarkable. We did a project not too long ago with kids in our art education program when we recreated the Wall of Respect on
really?
The front of the Institute of Contemporary Art. It was so great. It was so great to see who the kids put there. It was like such a variety of people, but It was wonderful, and we had and for many, many years we've had young people in our art education programs. We serve about 2,200 kids every year, and they always look at the history of muralism because we want them to have context about what public art is and the power it has and the people that came before us, because I think it's such a noble, wonderful tradition.
Has it been challenging to find and bring artists who might be marginalized into the mural conversation?
It has been. And, you know, for many years, back in the day when I worked for the Anti-Graffiti Network and it was me and the graffiti writers, people would often say to us from the art world, you all are not doing public art. And we would be, well, we're in public doing art. So if we're not doing public art, what are we doing? And you know what people would say? They would say, you're doing social work. But they'd say it in a pejorative way. And we'd be like, no, we're doing public art. We're going to hold our heads up high. So there was like a schism, right? Because it was like there was public art was seen as sculpture. And murals were like, no, they were sort of, you know, lower on the food chain. But then when we became Mural Arts and you saw the beautiful, like Meg Seligman's Broad and Spring Garden and, you know, Damon Chain did Jackie Robinson. And then there was like one after another, like all over the city. And now I think we've worked with 15,000 artists over the last 25 years, which is fantastic. It's like the WPA has come back to Philly. I think that there's, you know, just something to so I feel really vindicated, I guess, is what I feel. And so, but with vindication comes responsibility. So we have a huge responsibility to keep that door open so that new artists, artists of color, women artists, like it's like that door is open for people to come in and be able to create in public space. And so we just started a new fellowship program for Black artists. We're, you know, doing a second class for our muralist training. We have apprenticeship programs, internship programs, entrepreneurial programs. So it's really all about pathways. Like, how can we create a space where artists can come in, make a mark, we can help build capacity, and really help provide them with a pathway where they can, you know, possibly make a living or a part-time living as an artist. That's in part our responsibility.
We only have a couple of minutes left.
And I'm sorry.
No, please. This is all great information. But have to ask about the coronavirus pandemic and if it has affected the work of the Mural Arts Program.
Yes, we all had all our programs, our restorative justice program, our art education program, and our portrait program all went virtual. We also designed a coloring book to help kids cope with trauma. We have posters that people can download. We started a partnership with the Department of Public Health to do accurate public health messages translated into about six languages. So we just pivoted, and we drew on the strength of the team at Mural Arts and artists to help us think about how we could continue on our path and just be really creative. But I want to say good news. In a few weeks, we're going to start working outside with social distancing and masks.
That's great.
So there'll be a lot of really wonderful new projects coming online within a very short period of time.
How about funding? Mural Arts, I know, has endeavored to pay some of its artists. I mean, moving forward, are you going to get money from various sources to be able to continue to do this?
We will always pay artists. Every artist gets paid. Middle school students on up get paid. Our reentry program, everyone gets paid. Porchlight, it's one of our core values. We did have our budget reduced seriously, our city funds. We anticipated that. It's so many hard decisions I know have to get made.
Sure.
But it just means we have to be extra tenacious and look everywhere and be entrepreneurial and do everything we can to make sure the work moves forward, both our programs and our projects, because that's what I feel so deeply that the citizens of Philly deserve. Everyone should have art in their life, and our program should be open for people across the board throughout every neighborhood of the city. So it just is a reminder that we just can't take anything for granted. We can never be complacent, and we need to work doubly hard now, more than ever.
Jane, it's just been so great to have you with us. Can't wait to see the artists back out working in the open air. Jane is a founder and executive director of Mural Arts Philadelphia. Thanks again.
Oh, thank you. It was wonderful to talk to you. Take care.
You Bye. Too. And a reminder, we are here on social media. Simply head to whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Adam Stanishevsky. Our producers, John Ahrens, Debbie Builder, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for joining us today for Radio Times. Be well.